My name is Troy Clark. I am the president of General Motors in North America. I have been in Asia Pacific, actually, living in Shanghai, but responsible for General Motors activities from Mongolia to Australia, from Pakistan through Japan, and that's what I've been doing for the last several years. And I came back in July to assume this particular position, and at a time when North America is going through some pretty significant changes. I'll chat about that in just a minute if I could, but I would like to highlight to you or explain to you how, you know, how these type of meetings come about, to be very honest. Normally, when we get the opportunity to talk publicly in the auto industry, it tends to be like at auto shows where we have these wonderfully orchestrated backdrops of cars and models and all kinds of, you know, it's a very tailored environment for us to get up and try to tell our story. And we're usually talking to a lot of press over a short period of time or in large groups. And how those interactions go, some of you may have had some experience with that. We have a big corporate message that's very well developed by the world's experts on developing corporate messages. And we are talking to a lot of people who have a lot of questions. And basically, we shoot the corporate message. And then they start asking questions. And then we'll reload the message and shoot it again. And then they'll ask more questions. And then we'll shoot the message again. And some percentage of that message is usually published, and some percentage of that message is usually not. I had the opportunity to do something a little different at the Chicago Auto Show. So it was still an auto show venue, but was outside of the Detroit area. They had asked me if I would talk to four bloggers, four people who ran blog sites. And they were a very diverse group, actually. One was kind of a fashion blogger, was at kind of this end. And, you know, three chairs over was an environmental blogger. And we sat there at the auto show, no place in particular, special. And we actually had about 3 hours of dialogue, is what we had. I was certainly loaded with the corporate message. I certainly had my note cards. I could, you know, I could have given it to them in chapter and verse. And interestingly enough, within about 10 or 15 minutes, this dialogue broke out, which I thought was very unique and thought was very, very interesting. And so kind of turned to my public relations people and said, this feels a lot better to me, way of trying to communicate and talk than the way we typically do this. And part of the reason why was I learned a lot. Some of this stuff was stuff I didn't want to learn, right? I mean, people were making comments to me that, you know, I would hope they wouldn't make, but the fact that they made them to me was important because it does have an influence on the decisions that I get to make as we try to run our company and the decisions we make as we try to satisfy customers and as we look and make our plans for the future. So that's one piece of data. The second piece of data actually relates to my Asia experience. If I told you that the market in Australia looked and felt a lot different than the market in India, let's say, would that surprise you? Would it? So, you know, kind of when you go to Asia, you say, yep, it's many markets. People have different transportation needs. They're different business environments. They're different climates. There's different histories. There's different cultures. And you have to be good at kind of adapting and finding your place and finding your niche and being able to do business in those areas. And a lot of my training for that came from opportunities that I had to work in Latin America. And, you know, when I came back to the U.S., and probably about half of my career I'd spent outside of the U.S. and the other half inside the U.S. in different places, I came back with kind of a different realization, and that is most people think the U.S. is a single market. And in fact, the U.S. is not a single market. The U.S. is just as diverse in many regards as from India to Australia or from India to China. And I think a paradigm shift for me was we kind of sit in Detroit and we think about the U.S. market as a monolith, as something that's very homogeneous, or let's put it this way, we'll have a product portfolio or a set of answers to consumers' needs that are so broad that we really don't have to think about the market in much more different terms than one single market. And in fact, that's not the case, or at least that's not my theory and the theory of some others on the U.S. market. That in fact, the U.S. market is many different markets, and it's not different just from geography, but in fact, it's different from economy, culture, ethnicity, diversity, and needs, history, you know, a whole bunch of things. And, you know, my thoughts are, you know, how do we succeed? You know, we succeeded in the early part of this century by basically offering a product for every purpose and a product for every purse. You know, that's the Alfred P. Sloan mantra, which served our corporation very well. And I think it needs to be modified a little bit. I think it still can serve our corporation very well. But instead of just making sure that we fill out all the geometry or all the geometric proportions of cars in what we call segmentation and all the price points of cars in what we would call our pricing theory, there's probably some other more specific needs out there. And then for our company to be successful, we have to continue to strive to get closer and closer to a more realistic vision of what the market should be subdivided into and how to best satisfy that market. Now, that's not groundbreaking, by the way. You know, I mean, you've read this, you've heard this, you've probably even heard or read it as it relates to the auto industry. But, you know, the whole concept of CRM, customer relationship marketing, or personalization or customization and tailoring, you know, products to specific needs and segments is very common in a lot of elements of the consumer's goods industry, and it's something that we can have here as well. So that's kind of the genesis of this, and you know, and I really appreciate you coming, you know, to be very honest, and I'd really like to hear what you have to say. I'd really like to hear some comments from you. You may say some things that I'll try to respond to, and maybe have a different perspective. And if you ask me a question, I'll do my best to try to answer that question if I can. Also. But more important, you know, I kind of hope to learn from some of you, to be very honest. And California is a very important sales region for us, and it's not one where we've done a really good job at. And so after I leave here, I'm going to go spend some time with our sales folks, and we're going to talk about the kind of things that we're doing in this market. But, you know, you can help me by making me a lot smarter after this morning. I would like to share a couple of slides, though, just to give you a little bit of background on the kind of stuff that I work on. And I think it also probably will give a little fodder or a little information for you to use as we talk. Can I hit just any button here, or the button with the right arrow? There we go. As I indicated, you know, certainly California, and maybe California is more than one market. You know, California itself, depending upon how you divide it up, you know, could be many markets. And I guess that's what my particular, you know, paradigm is. It happens to be a market that we don't do real good in. There's a set of markets that kind of are around the edge of the country. We call the smile states, where our market share is in the under 20% range. And then there's the heartland of the company, which is where kind of where, you know, our products are born, and they tend to do very well. And our market share in those areas of the country tend to be around 30%. And when you kind of average it all out, our retail market share is in the neighborhood of 22 to 23%. But there is an extreme regionality to our sales, and California really reflects that, where in 2006, we had a little bit less than 17% market share. California does set a lot of standards, so to speak, or create a lot of trends, not just from a fashion standpoint, but in addition to that, you know, certainly from a regulatory standpoint. California has had since, you know, back in the late 1960s, early 1970s, you know, has been the leader in developing in the whole area of environmental and consumer regulation, and has really set the pace. And it's interesting because that regulation now is largely followed by 13 other states in the United States. You know, basically they're in one way, shape, or form in the process of adopting, you know, almost to the letter, but certainly to the intent, California-type regulations as it relates to a lot of elements, especially environmental laws. And so General Motors, California is a very important state for a whole bunch of reasons. And not the least of which is if we could figure out how to do better here, I suspect those results could be leveraged around those other smile states and certainly the 13 states that have similar regulatory conforms. We're in the middle of a turnaround process right now in General Motors. I'm sure a lot of you read over the course of the last 18 months a lot of dire predictions about our company and a lot of comments on, you know, our lack of financial performance. And so we're in the middle of a turnaround as we speak. We'd like to say that it's a product-led turnaround. The interesting thing is people don't buy General Motors. People really buy Chevrolets or Pontiacs or Buicks or Cadillacs. And so a big portion of the turnaround was, in fact, to invest even more in bringing new products to the market and bringing them to the market faster. A proof point that we think that that's working is the fact that this year about 40% of the vehicles that we sell in North America will actually be new products. And by new, we mean a product which is launched either in the current year or 6 months of the previous year. I've highlighted a couple of those products right here. Some of them you haven't seen yet. In the upper left-hand corner, I think just went on sale last month, is the new Saturn View. It's a new small sport utility, comes with a four-cylinder or a V6. In addition to that, comes with a BAS type hybrid, and in next year, I don't think we get that out yet this year, will come with a more sophisticated two-mode hybrid. And then this is also the vehicle that we announced that in 2009, 2010-ish, and I'll show you the chart with the exact date on it in a minute, will come in a plug-in hybrid. This should be our first plug-in hybrid vehicle that we'll bring out in a couple of years. And the vehicle on the right is the new Chevrolet Malibu. Should hit dealer showrooms later this year, October, November-ish kind of time frame. Four-cylinder, six-cylinder, four-speed transmission, six-speed transmission. And in addition to that, the first day it's available will also be available in the BAS, with a BAS hybrid as well. And then the bottom product, actually, we are currently starting production. This is the replacement CTS. It's it's a Cadillac luxury car. It should go on sale this summer. All these cars have, you know, from the automotive press anyway, garnered some form of praise, and we think that this certainly reflects more the type of both technical and design effort that we would like to make in the auto market. Another anecdotal piece of evidence, we think that our turnaround strategy is beginning to gain some traction. And this probably is at least in the 2003-2004 time frame, maybe it doesn't tell you anything, but in 2003 and 2004, the number one reason why people bought General Motors cars was because we had the biggest rebates and we had the biggest incentives on our vehicles. Brands like Pontiac in that kind of time frame were really becoming known as the rental car brand. Most Pontiacs you ever saw were basically at airport rental fleets. And Chevrolet was the car brand that was basically always on sale. And that's kind of how our brands were evolving in that time period. And you can see that, you know, number four and number three were actually price monthly payments, which is closely associated with incentives, because lowering prices either through lease support or financing assistance was actually another way for us to provide rebates and incentives. And in 2005, you can still see rebates and incentives was kind of a big deal. But in 2006, with the kind of initiative that we put into our product-led turnaround, which starts with the design and we think a little bit better engineering, in 2006, the number one reason why people bought General Motors cars is exterior styling. The number two reason is value for the money. And this is distinctly different in how we arrange the survey from incentives or low price or low monthly payments. And then the third point actually is fuel economy. Fuel economy, and I'll talk to you about that in just a minute. 2006, we started the year with some pricing and heavy incentive activity, and then we worked our way off of it as we went through the year, as we repriced and lowered our incentives. And actually, the results for the first quarter of 2006, because we do the study quarterly, the top item is exterior styling. The second item, I think, is value for the money. The third item is fuel economy. The fourth item is the warranty, our 5-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty. Price and monthly payments and rebates has actually dropped off of the list or continues to drift down on the list. Again, anecdotal in its nature, but you know, we'd like to believe it's a reinforcing point that we're kind of at least have the boat pointed in the right direction. We talked about fuel economy. You know, why would people why would fuel economy one of the reasons why people purchase General Motors cars? Probably a little known fact. We did provide some level of promotion on this topic last year, and you'll probably see some more going forward. But General Motors does have 23 models that get over 30 miles per gallon on the highway. And in that are some of our most popular and some of the most popularly purchased cars in the United States. In particular, let's point out the Chevrolet Impala is in the top 10 vehicles in terms of volume that are purchased in the United States. And the Chevrolet Cobalt, again, another vehicle within the top 10 in terms of total volume of vehicles purchased in the U.S. So, you know, we do think there is some good value, good styling, and in fact, on top of that, you know, some fuel economy that can be purchased in our vehicle fleet. And then the other thing which probably contributes to that is we have been a very large promoter of biofuels, or what we would call flex fuel vehicles. You've probably seen our promotion about Live Green, Go Yellow. We have a real strong commitment to the subject area of biofuels. You know, one of the beneficial but somewhat unintended consequences of the original CAFE legislation was the fact that there was a flex fuel credit. Now, a lot of people can say how that got in there, and probably got in to favor the farm lobby, to be very honest with you, but the fact of the matter is that it resulted in the development of some unique and proprietary technology that was primarily developed by the U.S. auto industry to be able to determine the percent of ethanol that might be in your gasoline at any point in time. And that allows us actually to build these flex fuel vehicles very economically. And it's something that's unique to the U.S. manufacturers. It's not that it couldn't be duplicated by foreign manufacturers, but so far it just hasn't. We know that they're kind of working in that regard. And this is pretty interesting, we think, because when you think about energy, we think about it in three pieces. You know, we certainly think about the cost of ownership, that, you know, customers have a right to expect high mileage, okay, or low cost, basically, as they're paying for their transportation. The second way we think about it is reducing greenhouse gases or carbon-related emissions. And then the third way we think about it is in terms of energy security, reducing gas or oil imports. This is a very interesting technology. It's interesting because it's, you know, no pun intended, it's homegrown. It's still somewhat a cottage industry. There's tons of opportunity for development, both in the technology and the distribution of this. It is not largely distributed outside of the Midwest. I think there's only one station in California, for instance, that has an E85 pump. But I got to tell you, it's very popular in the Midwest. I was talking to the governor of Wisconsin. He actually ran for office on this slogan, "Send your money to the Midwest, not the Mideast. We speak your language." And so it's a very powerful concept. And it's so powerful, it's the kind of thing that could be done in a big way in a very short period of time. We currently have 2 million vehicles on General Motors vehicles on the road that are flexible fuel capable. We've made a commitment that we can make 50% of our vehicles by 2012. We'll actually make an additional 400,000 every year, but we can have 50% of our portfolio flex fuel capable by 2012. And the fact of the matter is that the government said, no, you really need to do more. We could probably do more on top of that. That's really just our normal model cycle changeover, which would allow us to support this particular technology. The real payoff of this, however, is that the president's recommendation on CAFE, which is about a 4% per year improvement for about a 5-year period of time, from 2012 through 2017, at the end of the day, probably saves 8 billion gallons of gasoline, 8 billion gallons of imported gas. If through that same period of time, just all the vehicles who are flex fuel capable, if they could get E85 through that same period of time, it would save about 38 billion gallons of gasoline. And so flex fuels or E85 is a method that you could actually reduce. A 4% CAFE would reduce the rate at which imported oil grew. Broad-based adoption of a flex fuel or biofuel strategy, you could actually reduce over that same period of time the amount of imported oil. So we encourage certainly a lot of people to look at this, and it is a great subject of debate, but you know, there's so much promise there that we think it's really worth debating. We do have a hybrid portfolio, and we're coming into the strong part of our hybrid portfolio. Our hybrid strategy really began with the GM with an Allison drive unit for a bus, and we've sold over 500 of these buses. Really makes a lot of sense because they pay for themselves in a very short period of time. And in cities or places like Yosemite Park, for instance, that you know they're concerned about basically smog from just the transportation that's in there, this is a great way for them to be able to reduce that. So we really started with buses. And then we had a very simple hybrid system in a pickup truck that we basically are finishing running out this year. And then we ran into what we called these BAS, these single mode hybrids, start-stop hybrids, basically, which is the Saturn View, the Saturn Aura currently on the road as well, and then we'll have the Chevrolet Malibu. Later this year, we'll introduce the Tahoe and Yukon. This is a rear-wheel drive hybrid application. It's a consortium between ourselves, Daimler Chrysler, and BMW. It is a two-mode system. It will arguably be the most advanced hybrid system on the road. Easier to engineer, basically, on something that is large in its packaging in general. And then it really applies well when you're saying if the goal is to save a lot of gallons of fuel, then you put it on a vehicle that gets low fuel gas mileage by virtue of its size and characteristics. And so we roll that out basically on those rear-wheel drive applications. And then in 2008, next year, basically, we'll roll out the first front-wheel drive application of this. Two-mode hybrid, the significance being that It improves your city fuel economy, but also it has a second electric motor and gear set which enter into your highway fuel economy. And in the case of trucks, it really doesn't give away anything on towing yet. It's still a very robust, it's still a very robust system. And then in 2010 calendar year is when this particular vehicle, the Saturn View, will be available as a plug-in hybrid. And, so we're moving very quickly in that direction. We also are big in fuel cells. We'd like to believe that we're actually a leader in the development of an application of the automotive fuel cell stack. We are in the process of distributing right now, and we'll do this between now and through the end of the year, over 100 fuel cell Equinoxes. The first batch of these actually went to the U.S. Army, and the balance of them really go into customers' hands. The three markets where they go are California, New York, and Washington, D.C. area, where fuel cell refueling stations, you know, have been set up. So this is the largest fuel cell fleet. We're very attracted to the fuel cell. You know, the key to the fuel cell has been, how can you develop something which has the durability of the current internal combustion engine and has a cost structure that can grow in with volume to something around the cost of an internal combustion engine? That's when something can really become, you know, a viable alternative, you know, to replace the internal combustion engine going forward. The fuel cell, you know, you put hydrogen in it, it takes oxygen from the air, it produces electricity, water is the byproduct. This is a great technology that eventually could take certain segments of the auto world, you know, totally out of the imported oil, totally out of the environmental equation, and still be very economical so that it's the kind of thing that people can really afford in real cars. And then the concept that we demonstrated at the Detroit Auto Show is the what we call our E-Flex architecture. And this is the vehicle, we showed it as a concept car called the Chevrolet Volt. The Chevrolet Volt is an electrically driven vehicle. 100% of the time, the wheels are always driven by an electric motor. It has a lithium, an advanced lithium-ion battery that, when fully charged, will give you 40 miles of driving capability on pure electric power. In normal driving type modes and conditions, this is with air conditioning and with realistic acceleration, etc. As a matter of fact, our first simulations of basically battery cells could tell us that it may be even more than 40 miles, to be very honest. 78% of the public of the U.S. who drive cars drive less than 40 miles on a daily basis. So many people would own this product, and it would just be an electric function totally as an electric car. You plug it in at night, it would take 4 to 6 hours to charge. A full charge at current electricity rates would be in the neighborhood of 40 cents. So you could drive this vehicle for 40 cents a day of basically, you know, the energy that you use to get back and forth if you don't have to engage what's called the range extender. So let's say you drive 19 miles to work. You're at work, you get a call, you got to go someplace else, it's 100 miles away. What do you do? This was a problem with our old EV1 car. Hey, what do? Sorry, you don't get to do much. You got to go get a cab or have somebody come pick you up. In this particular vehicle, you walk out, you get in your car, and you start driving. When the battery gets to a certain level of discharge, there's a range extender in the vehicle, and this is why we call it E-Flex. We showed the vehicle in the Detroit Auto Show with a internal combustion engine range extender. It was a three-cylinder engine that would start up and turn a generator, which would recharge the battery, and it would recharge the battery at a rate faster than you would consume, so you basically would charge the battery for a period of time, then the engine would shut off automatically, but the vehicle continues to drive on electric power. The engine runs at about 2,000 RPM, and it doesn't have to go up and down, so it starts and it runs in a very efficient, you know, high fuel economy range. In the gasoline version, the range extended version of this, it had a little less than a 12-gallon gasoline tank on it. And with 12 gallons or a little less than 12 gallons of gas, it has a drivable range of over 600 miles. And so as you would be driving like down the freeway and the battery's at a depleted charge, the engine starts up, you just keep driving, the battery gets charged up, the engine stops, and you're on pure electrical power for the next 30 or 40 miles, and then the engine starts back up and it recharges the battery again. One of the good things about the EV1 vehicle, we have a lot of experience with the electrical components of this particular car and how to make it work. What we don't have a lot of experience with is the battery. The lithium-ion battery is a parallel invention as we attempt to develop the other systems of the car. Again, we called it E-Flex because we showed this in, I think, the Geneva Auto Show with a diesel engine in place of the gasoline engine that could run the range extender. And we showed it in the Shanghai Auto Show with a fuel cell as the range extender. And if you put the fuel cell in it, then the battery only has to be about half as big. And that's good because we need that space to store hydrogen to give you a similar kind of performance ranges. You know, we are really working hard on this product. This is kind of our moonshot because we think it represents, you know, maybe not an exact final form, but certainly an intention, you know, where a big step for at least a segment of the product, important segment called passenger cars of the product of the next, you know, basically the next golden age of what we hope would be the auto industry. So Chevrolet Volt, E-Flex architecture. I think you've probably read it in the press, although we made no official announcements. We certainly allude to the fact that it's our hope we could put this vehicle in play at the end of the decade. And that's kind of a flavor for what we're doing. If I could put somehow I didn't kind of get a slide in there that I meant to get in there. In December, I think it was December or November, I was actually with Rick Wagner, our chairman, when he came to the LA Auto Show. And at the LA Auto Show, Rick kind of made a policy speech, you know, for General Motors at that time. And Rick really described a vision of energy diversity. There is no limits to the growth of the car market in the world. The auto market today around the world is about a total of 70 million units. And I've had the opportunity to work in developing countries, and I just got to tell you, people still want cars. People still want cars. The U.S. market is a kind of stable market right now, at about 17 million sales on an annual basis. But the China market is growing 10% per year. And before the end of the next decade, maybe even before the midpoint of the next decade, will probably be a larger car market than the U.S. as a whole. So it goes from a market of 7 million probably to a market of 20 million by somewhere in the 2013, 2015 kind of time range. India's right behind them, man. India's right behind them. They want cars as well. Their infrastructure is really set up better for cars than basically other parts of types of transportation as well. For us to believe that cars can always be propelled by gasoline or even diesel fuel is just not the right conclusion to come to. And that has nothing to do with an argument about how much gas there is left in the world. It's just that it's probably not reasonable to expect that this industry could get to 100 million units of sales on an annual basis and it all be powered by gasoline and diesel. So Rick described what he believed. He says, hey, we need to start this industry on a path of energy diversity. And that energy diversity can come in a number of forms. Certainly biofuels represents an almost immediate way we can begin to create some energy diversity. Hybrid vehicles, parallel hybrid electric vehicles, gas electric vehicles could in fact be, is in fact another very important method of energy diversity. But ultimately, you know, for us, you know, it really points to the electrification of the car. Because at the end of the day, the most efficient distribution system that's already in place is in fact the electrical grid. So unlike hydrogen fuel cells, you don't got to figure out how to distribute the hydrogen. But electricity, we've already figured out how to distribute it. And on top of that, you can diversify the source of the electricity. You can make that electricity from clean coal, you can make it from wind, you can make it from nuclear, you can make it from solar. So, you know, the ideal model for energy diversification, again, and this might be a 20, 25-year vision, is points us in the direction of the electrification of the car. How fast, how well, what will customers think? A lot of issues we've got to get worked out, but that's kind of the compass point for us. That's the true north. That's where we're trying to move our company and the technology that supports transportation. So I could talk a lot more, but I won't. I'd rather be quiet here for a minute and then actually ask you for, you know, for your comments, your questions, or your thoughts in this area. And I'm truly interested in what you have to say.
I'd love to hear more about the way you're thinking of segmenting the market differently than used to, along the lines of diversity and how these things might overlay each other and how it might affect your thoughts.
Well, you know, it's kind of like... if I could say, I don't know that it's so much about, okay, I'll say here's how we view it, okay? We view it as cycles of learning, and we view it in a term of sense and respond. So I can, you know, so what I need to do is I need to find a way to get into the communities and understand, you know, what works or what doesn't work. So almost by definition, we need to have a strong interface to the internet, where almost every possible way you can think of segmenting the market can be comprehended. And it's very interesting. Let me give you an example. There's some internet sites we do business with, okay, that are segmented sites. You know, like young professionals, let's say in the Detroit area. And so we create a business arrangement where, and this is a very interesting, it was a thing interesting to me. The way the company normally does it is we have big advertising agencies who create all of our creative, the image, the ad, you know, and all of that kind of stuff. And then we just go pay people to go put our ads on their sites. That's how we've done it for a long time. And it largely doesn't work. You know, I mean, basically we're arranging those ads so that there's some form of click-through to one of our sites so that we can get into the next thing. So you can measure this concept of click-through, you know, very significantly. So we step back a minute. Okay, there's this young woman who runs this site for young professionals in the Detroit area. We decide to run an experiment. Hey, tell you what, here's what I want to do. I, you know, young professionals is a very important target segment for us. Tell you what we're going to do. I will pay you only when somebody clicks through to my site. So I'll pay you when they only click through to my site. And she says, okay, that's fine, but then you let me do the creative. Let me understand your products, your company, what you're doing better, and I will then tell the story. That has caused a huge deal in the company, because, you know, it is hard to let go of your advertising and your messaging and how, and there's a lot of compromises with it. But basically, so she does that, and she doubles the rate of click-throughs almost immediately, because she knows this community that she somewhat is related to and represents. And so one way to do it is to say, I don't know that I could become an expert in all these communities, right? I don't know that I can get to know those, okay? But you know what? I can have trusted partners who really are members of those communities, who really would have an interest in helping represent us appropriately, you know, but not misrepresenting because of the equity that their particular, you know, website has to that community as well. That's kind of one of the most exciting things that we're doing. We took 18%, you know, we spend billions of dollars on an annual basis on advertising. And ours is an industry, I call it carpet bombing, right? It's 30-second commercials that we drop on television. That kind of tends to how we do it. We took 18% of our advertising budget this year and shifted it all into the digital media space. And quite frankly, it's a learning, because most of the people who do that kind of promotion for us inside the company are, you know, are kind of 50-year-old guys who are great at making 30-second commercials that go on ESPN. But that's not the target market. You know, we do a great job with that particular demographic, by the way. But, you know, that's not the target market. So we're trying to reach out and learn how to do it a different way.
And that's from a marketing standpoint. What about from a product design standpoint? How do you get your
Does that show up? Well, we use some pretty conventional mechanisms, by the way. We use focus groups into these targeted communities, basically, where we bring them into our design, or we bring some of our design concepts to them, and we ask their critique. We take 100 Equinox vehicles and put them in the hands of real families, the kind of people who we think are going to drive these things. That kind of stuff looks a lot like kind of traditional market resources. With inside the company, we have, we call them affinity groups. How many affinity groups do we have? So we have a very strong women's affinity group, for instance, in General Motors. One of the things, this is all the women that work in General Motors all over the world. They're all kind of networked together, and one of their charges is they give us product input, they give us product critique. We have a alternative lifestyle affinity group, and we do the same thing with them. And, you know, trying to use our resources that we have. I mean, we have a lot of people that work for General Motors, you know, across a very large age demographic and across a pretty decent geography demographic, you know, maybe not as representative as it should be, but, you know, that's one of the things that we're trying to do on that. But a lot of it looks like conventional marketing in that regard. If you have any ideas, I'd be wide open to hear.
We've got a couple hands over here, but you mentioned about California, maybe Los Angeles, in particular, being a problem for you.
I don't think it's any secret to step off the airplane here in Los Angeles and drive into town. It's a world of different from Detroit. I mean, you won't see General Motors cars,
mm-hmm.
not trucks, but cars that aren't really rentals. How do you have to even try to make inroads, or is there any sort of plan directed at this kind of thing? It's a major issue. And you have something like a Chevy Volt that you could have them lining up for, you know, for blocks, if it were here today. But I don't know, I don't see that. You know, how do you break the image problem that GM is having? I think selling to a market like Los Angeles, which is basically about Toyota, Honda, Nissan, BMW, and Mercedes and Lexus. I mean, it is. It just is.
Mm-hmm. No, we recognize that.
Does GM have any plans?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we got lots of plans. Lots of plans. I could tell you some of the plans, you know, I could tell you a lot of the plans haven't worked, okay, is what I could tell you. I mean, you know, Los Angeles last year, I think, you know, all General Motors cars, let's just talk cars, you know, I think we sold 8,000 in Los Angeles, you know. I think they sold 11,000 Priuses alone, one model, and I think Toyota sold 35,000, you know, cars in Los Angeles market. So that kind of shows you, I have eight brands, right? I don't have eight brands of cars, I think I had six brands of cars or so, but, you know, so... okay, so the brand strategy that we developed in the early part of the century, okay, that's not been an effective strategy, right? So we do have plans, but if you think about it, just to give you some clue, okay, the capacity is fairly balanced to demand across the country for us. You know, we don't make cars that don't get sold, and you know, we haven't for a couple of years. General Motors is not a company who makes cars and then parks them along the fence and then tries to go figure out how to sell them. A lot of people do that. You know, ours are all cars when they come off the end of the factory floor, or they are a dealer has decided, has ordered that car. I want that car. Okay, is really how it is. Now, if you think about this though, a dealer in Los Angeles doesn't order many cars, just because he hasn't been able to sell many. So now I'm a customer in Los Angeles and I say, hey, I think I'm really interested in going to or in looking at a General Motors car. Most parts of the country, the buying process is still, you'd like to buy the car off the lot. You don't want to order the car and have to wait. You want to buy the car off the lot. So, kind of by definition, if the Chevrolet dealer doesn't have a lot of cars on the lot, there's not a lot of choice. And so your possibilities of hooking up to a sale are automatically reduced. That's a very simple thing, isn't it? I mean, a very simple thing. But the systems that we apply for the distribution of our cars, where the dealers themselves are basically ordering their cars, you know, kind of works against us in the car segment. Works for us in the truck segment. You know, California is one of our biggest truck markets, and dealers love to sell them, right? So a lot of this starts right at the retail part and working all the way back up, right? So as you see these cars, as you see Chevrolet Volts, for instance, or you see Malibus and Malibu Hybrids and that kind of stuff, you know, how do you prime the pump so that, you know, the dealers will hold more inventory of the right kind of inventory? And so, you know, should we send all the hybrids here for a while, you know, as we bring out the new, should we send all the Volts here for a while, you know, just to the Los Angeles market or the California market? You know, these are the kind of things that we ask ourselves and that we're obviously involved in. And part of the reason why I'm here, I'm very interested in what you all have to say about that.
I wanted to make a comment and then ask you a question.
Mm-hmm.
My comment is this, that your research into the plug-in hybrid and also the Chevy Volt is extremely encouraging. And my comment is that I would love to see an American manufacturer be the first to win the plug-in hybrid race, which I'm sure is going on behind closed doors and with many other manufacturers. You talked about the introduction in 2010 of the first plug-in hybrid, which would be the Saturn View. Is that model year 2010, or could we see that in 2009? And then the other part of the question is, with the Volt, is that, you said you'd like to put it in play by the end of the decade. Can you be any more specific about that?
I think on the chart that I showed, getting to the View question, you know, by the way, I think the plug-in hybrid there, I think, is a calendar year 2010 availability. It's a very tight developmental path for us because, again, we're working on this lithium-ion battery development. And The chemistry of the lithium-ion battery is pretty well known, but the configuration is such a... If I could just go back just for a minute, I don't want to make technologists out of all of you, because you're probably better technologists than I. The kind of batteries that are used in current hybrids are power batteries. They need to recharge quickly, and then they discharge quickly because you're basically using bursts of that energy either to help pull away from a traffic light or to give you a little bit of additional acceleration when you're on the highway. The lithium-ion battery that we need for a plug-in hybrid is an energy battery. It has to acquire a lot of energy over a very short period of time, and it has to discharge a lot of energy over a longer period of time as well. So if you think of the battery as being a whole bunch of cells, the chemistry and the characteristics of the cells themselves is not such a big deal. It's really how do you put those all together with a controller, with a cooler, because lithium-ion batteries happen to work well in a particular temperature. How do you package it in the car, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that's all the development that is happening concurrent on the critical path. If we hit home runs along all those kind of things, we'll get that out as soon as we can, because the balance of the vehicle is there to include the electrical drive systems, even as we speak. So it's really the battery happens to be the critical path. Because the electronics industry, many years ago, went to the east, to the west, I guess from here, right? We don't have a lot of battery technology in the U.S. Lithium-ion batteries are the batteries that come in your laptop. They aren't made in the U.S. They happen to be made someplace else. And with a lot of manufacturing, you know, so goes the technology development. So very few lithium-ion people in the U.S. There's a company in Massachusetts, a spinoff of an MIT activity called A123. And I think they make some batteries for like Black & Decker power tools. So what we have done is we have reached out to like a company like A123, and we've written a development contract for them and Johnson Control, because Johnson Control makes regular batteries, and said, you guys got the production technology, you guys got the cell technology, here's some money, please go develop us a battery. But not to put eggs in one basket, there's another company called Cobasys, which makes nickel metal hydride batteries, which won't work well for plug-in applications, and a company called SAF, which is SAF, is a French company who makes lithium-ion batteries, and we've asked them to do the same thing. So it's kind of like a developmental race, and we'd like to win that race too, by the way. But you know, truthfully, you know, and I'll just be candidly honest, the most energy being put into lithium-ion battery development is in Japan, and that technology is not available to us. It is not available to us because you may have read 2 weeks ago, I think, or 3 weeks ago, the Japanese government has decided to provide $1.8 billion grant for the development of lithium-ion batteries for automotive applications. It is a strategic technology, and as such, the companies who are involved in that, okay, can't help us, so to speak. So we have to develop a home team consortium to develop battery technology. But it isn't like steel making, right? Where we've been in it for a long time. No, we as a technology center haven't kind of been in that kind of stuff. So we got to kind of ramp that kind of stuff up. And that's one of the great things about HRL, for instance, and the kind of role that HRL can play. It's not about the science. You know, the science for the cell largely comes from the U.S. The chemistry largely comes from, you know, research institutions that are here. It's really about, okay, taking it from, you know, the laboratory to something that really works in a vehicle. And I would ask you to think about this just for 1 minute. I mean, this isn't like your Black & Decker kind of thing, right? Unfortunately, cars get in accidents. I mean, you know, you hear about laptop batteries catching on fire. Okay, you know, hey, what happens if, what happens when you get in an accident? You got a big lithium-ion battery sitting between you and the passenger in your car. You know, that has to be engineered in such a fashion that, and these are going to be very high voltage, for instance, you know, so it has to be engineered in such a fashion that it comprehends all of that kind of stuff. So it isn't as simple, I think, as making a drill. And when we bring this out, it has to be bulletproof. You know, we will not compromise the safety or integrity of the passengers or those systems. That would be the exact wrong thing to do. So although it might be great to win the race, you know, okay, we're going to do it right, though. I mean, that's got to be the first commitment. But let me just say one more thing on the battery thing, though, because I don't want to say this thing with I don't want to kind of be down in the mouth about this thing. We're extremely excited about it. I just got to tell you, it's like waking up on Christmas morning and finding there's an Erector set under the Christmas tree, right? I mean, you know, you put something together, and the first one you do isn't kind of cool, but by that night, I'm telling you, you're a master at what you can make out of your Erector set, and we are going through that same kind of excitement around batteries. In our company and with the partners that we're working with. And quite frankly, we are blatantly lobbying that there is a role for government in this, okay? If batteries are in fact the core technology for not just cars, lithium-ion batteries, but for other things, is there a stake for American industry in that? Is there a role for American government in that? You know, U.S. government support for the development of advanced batteries is what? This is a quiz.
Less dependence on foreign oil?
No, no, I mean, how much money? Pretty darn close. It's $14 million. It's $14 million, you know. We spend more than that on batteries in a week, and we're not even in the battery business. So we're very excited about this, by the way, and we're going to get this figured out, because it isn't, I would say it is not rocket science. It is rocket science, but it just so happens it's the kind of rocket science that we can do in this country, and we're going to do that. So, yeah, and we can chat some more if you like at that thing, and we'll come back to your Volt question a little bit if you like.
Yeah, I just had a question about in the past. In your opinion, do you feel that the various divisions of General Motors have worked well together from an efficiency perspective? And if not, what steps are being made for more collaboration, more economies of scale, more
sure.
efficiency within these various divisions? Because as a consumer, I remember being a little kid and asking my dad, well, why does General Motors own all these companies, and all these companies have different names, or they seemingly are very independent? So what from a technical from a technology perspective, and economies of scale perspective, what changes are being made to let
yep.
the divisions work better together?
Yep. I'll give you just a real quick history lesson, okay, because I think you'll find it interesting how we run the company today. But you are right. General Motors was put together through a series of acquisitions, not only in the U.S., but actually throughout the world. So, for instance, Pontiac was a separate company that was acquired by General Motors at one time. Chevrolet was a separate company, Buick, Oldsmobile. Okay, so all these brands, in fact, and for a long time operated as a separate company. Very well documented in the book by Albert B. Sloan called My Years with General Motors, really talks about how the company operated as separate companies for a period of time. Basically, well into the 1980s, it became very evident that, there's kind of a flaw in this because the competition was all internal. It was all scrimmaging within your high school, right? We were never playing another school. We were just kind of scrimmaging internally. And the things, I worked at Pontiac at the time, and I remember, our number one competitor was Oldsmobile, and they were still on the same team, that we are. But by God, we fought like hell to beat Oldsmobile in sales and technology and design and styling and things like that. And obviously, we had the wrong focus. So there was an effort in the 1980s to create a different company. And so we went through this very ill-fated reorganization where we had BOC, CPC. We had a kind of a luxury car group and a non-luxury car group. And, that kind of didn't work very well either, to be very honest, because instead of having, six teams, we ended up having kind of two teams. And, it's the same kind of deal. In early 1990s, when Jack Smith became the chairman of General Motors, Jack Smith's mantra was, it's really one company. And he disassembled all of that, and we really became one company. We had one vehicle development process in the U.S. So product engineering, one design, one manufacturing organization, et cetera, et cetera. And we had marketing divisions. So the marketing divisions are just the marketers of our cars. So Chevrolet isn't this group of people who make cars anymore. Chevrolet is really a bunch of guys and gals who sell cars. Okay, the guys who make cars are General Motors, okay, and they have this one company. And so that's the transformation we went through in the 1990s, and it worked fairly well. By the way, tough to do, but, we went through that. And then, actually, just a couple of years ago, and this was very evident to me because I was in Asia at the time, we still competed with each other kind of on a country basis. And here's how we did that. We had, Opel in Europe, and we have like Chevrolet over here, and there's a fixed pot of corporate resources, and we're kind of competing against each other for where that investment would flow. And so we said, this really doesn't work well enough either. So Opel, turns out, isn't a company that has its, back then it was, but now Opel is, in fact, a marketing division as well. And so our vehicle development process is global. Bob Lutz runs a process with 14 design studios around the world, 20 major engineering centers, and that's all done at the same time using common architectures, using common components, so that we can get the best component in the right place at the right time. The manufacturing world is run by Gary Cowger. He runs all of our manufacturing facilities around the world. Bo Anderson runs a global purchasing network. So just since 2004, we are a global company. We call it Global Functional. Okay, in all the functions. And then what we have marketing divisions whose responsibility is to provide customer input from their markets and then also, sell the vehicle. So those are big steps of things that we have done to do that. The next thing is, how do you go to market? So we went to market for a long time with, there were Chevy dealerships and Buick dealerships and Pontiac dealerships and GMC dealerships. And to be able to give everybody the products they need, we need to have 90 different products, which 90 times whatever the development cost of that vehicle is, right? And 90 times having to have the creativity to make the vehicles look different enough. And we've been criticized for badge engineering, right? Or you change the grill, but the rest of the car stays the same. You know, so we decided this isn't the right way to do it either. So we decided we want to present ourselves to the market as four channels, like four stores, right? So you go to, you know, you go to a department store, they have several different brands. Well, it's the same kind of thing with us. We have a Chevrolet channel. Chevrolet trucks, which by it's its own brand, Chevrolet cars, and a very good sub-brand called Corvette. That's what gets sold in Chevrolet stores. And then we have these other stores, today we call them BPG. They may be called something different in the future, Buick, Pontiac, GMC. So they have a truck brand called GMC, they have a sporty car brand called Pontiac, and a more, you know, a conservative luxury type car called Buick. In that, then I don't have to have 22 different Pontiacs. I only have a handful of Pontiacs. You know, we suggest in the future you'll see three Pontiacs, maybe four Pontiacs, but they'll be great Pontiacs. They'll be like the Solstice, right? They'll be what we'd like to call seductive performance. We don't have to have a Pontiac economy car because Pontiac doesn't have to have an economy car. And so think about that. We can really do a better job putting pure Pontiac into that for the people who want Pontiacs. And we don't have to kind of develop the product portfolio because, we have a whole bunch of dealers out there that we've got an obligation to keep them full of products. And we've made a lot of transition on that. The whole dealership network isn't changed over yet because we're letting it happen very organically. But, you know, over 65% of all Buick, Pontiac, GMCs last year were, in fact, sold through these combined BPG channels. And then our goal is to have a luxury channel, Cadillac, Hummer, Saab. And then our goal is to have the Saturn channel, which is, you know, basically a very unique product and shopping experience. So these are the things that we've done to evolve from these separate companies that are fighting each other all the time, squandering resources, not listening to the customers, you know, not being more focused. Hopefully these are the kind of things that it's kind of like changing your tire on the freeway while you're still driving. So it's hard to do these things, but it's the right thing to do. So that's one of the ways
we're looking at. The goal would be to have it in a consumer's mind that Chevy means this.
Yep.
Pontiac means this.
Right.